This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Little Book That Still Beats the Market by Joel Greenblatt. Read by Adam Gruper. Please see the included PDF file for all tables and the appendix that are referred to in this program.
Introduction to the 2010 edition. Well, it's been more than 5 years since I wrote the original edition of The Little Book That Beats the Market. While I very much enjoyed writing the book, I wasn't expecting much. My first book, written in the 90s, was only a modest success, which is to say it bombed pretty badly. Only one publisher, thank you, David Pugh, was willing to publish my next attempt, which turned out to be the first edition of The Little Book. With a microscopic advance payment, darn you, David Pugh, and after factoring in agent fees, taxes, and the usual shipping and handling charges, I didn't expect to lose too much on the effort. To my happy surprise, the book ended up selling 300,000 copies worldwide, and has now been translated into 16 different languages, 15 and a half of which, unfortunately, I do not understand. My goal in writing the book was fairly straightforward. The world of finance, particularly the stock market part, is intimidating to many people. Yet investment decisions obviously play a huge role in determining future security, retirement options, and the ability to provide for loved ones. Since the stock market is such an important component in most people's investment portfolios, I wanted to write a short, accessible guide that not only explained things in language that even my kids could understand, but also provided a great option for many investors. Shortly after finishing the first edition of The Little Book, though, I had a bit of a panic attack. What if individual investors actually followed my advice? What if they believed and understood the logic of the magic formula provided in the book, but then didn't calculate the formula correctly, or used poor data sources found free on the internet? I had visions of a dad or grandma I was trying to help actually ending up losing some of their hard-earned savings by not having the proper resources to implement the strategy. So we quickly put together magicformulainvesting.com as a free resource for people that both did the calculations correctly and used a high-quality source for the data. This resource remains free, and I sincerely hope that in conjunction with understanding the book, it will continue to serve as a great help to people in the past and future. At the very least, having the website gave me one less thing to worry about over the last 5 often interesting years. Investing is hard. That's why having a disciplined, methodical, long-term investment strategy that makes sense is essential to making it through and being successful in almost any market environment. But it can't just make sense. It must make sense to you. Having a deep understanding is the only way to stick with a long-term strategy that might not work over shorter time periods. Toward that goal, I have added an afterword to this 2010 edition. The afterword discusses events, results, and lessons learned since the original edition was published in 2005. And the good news is this. Things often have a way of looking a bit different than we've seen before, and sometimes they even might be. It's just that the lessons and the principles from the original little book remain the same. Nevertheless, it's always helpful to review and learn them again. I hope this new afterword to this edition helps. Good luck. Introduction to the original edition. This book was originally inspired by my desire to give each of my 5 children a gift. I figured if I could teach them how to make money for themselves, then I would be giving them a great gift, truly one that would keep giving. I also figured that if I could explain how to make money in terms that even my kids could understand, the ones already in 6th and 8th grades anyway, then I could pretty much teach anyone how to be a successful stock market investor. While the concepts covered in this book may seem simple, perhaps too simple for sophisticated investors, Each step along the way is there for a reason. Stay with it, and I assure you the payoff for both beginning and experienced investors will be huge. After more than 25 years of investing professionally, and after 9 years of teaching at an Ivy League business school, I am convinced of at least two things. Number one, if you really want to beat the market, most professionals and academics can't help you. And number two, that leaves only one real alternative. You must do it yourself. Luckily, that might not be such a bad thing. As improbable as it may seem, you can learn to beat the market. Through a simple step-by-step process, this book can teach you how. To help you along, I have included a magic formula. The formula is simple. It makes perfect sense, and with it, you can beat the market, the professionals, and the academics by a wide margin. And you can do it with low risk. The formula has worked for many years, and will continue to work even after everyone knows it. Although the formula is easy to use and will not take much of your time, it will work for you only if you make the effort to fully understand why it works. Along the way, you will learn how to view the stock market, why success eludes almost all individual and professional investors, how to find good companies at bargain prices, how you can beat the market all by yourself. I have included an appendix section in the PDF file that accompanies this program for those of you with a higher level of financial training, but it is not necessary for people to read or understand it to be able to understand and apply the methods found in this book. The truth is that you don't need an MBA to beat the market. Knowing lots of sophisticated formulas or financial terms isn't what makes the difference. Understanding the simple concepts in this book is. So please, enjoy this gift. May the small investment of time, and the money you spent to buy this program, greatly enrich your future. Good luck. Chapter 1. Jason's in the sixth grade, and he's making a fortune. My son and I see him almost every day on the way to school. There's Jason in the back of his chauffeur-driven limousine, all decked out in cool clothes and dark sunglasses. Ah, to be 11 years old, rich and cool. Now that's the life. Okay, maybe I'm getting a little carried away. I mean, it's not really a limousine. It's kind of a scooter. And the cool clothes and sunglasses part, well, that's not really true either. It's more like his belly hanging over a pair of jeans, no sunglasses, and what he had for breakfast still stuck to his face. But that's not the point. Jason's in business. It's a simple business, but it works. Jason buys gum, 4 or 5 packs a day. It's 25 cents for a pack, and 5 sticks of gum to a package. According to my son, once in school, Jason transforms himself into a superhero of sorts. Neither rain nor sleet nor evil hall monitors can keep Jason from selling his gum. I guess his customers like buying from a superhero, or maybe they're just stuck in school. But however he does it, Jason sells each stick of gum for 25 cents. Supposedly, I've never actually seen it myself. Jason kind of shoves an open pack of gum into a potential customer's face and repeats, "You want some? You know you want some," until his fellow student either collapses or forks over a quarter. The way my son has it figured, that's 5 sticks at 25 cents each. So Jason rakes in $1.25 for each pack he sells. At a cost of 25 cents per pack, that means Jason is making $1 of pure profit on every pack he can shove. I mean, sell. At 4 or 5 packs a day, that's a lot of money. So after one of our daily Jason sightings, I asked my sixth grader, "Gee, how much do you think this guy Jason can make by the end of high school?" My son, we'll call him Ben, even though his real name is Matt, started whizzing through the calculations using all his brain power and a few fingers. "Let's see," he replied. "That's, say, $4 a day times 5 days a week. So $20 a week, 36 weeks of school, that's $720 a year. If he has 6 years left until he graduates, that's somewhere over $4,000 more he'll make by the end of high school." Not wanting to miss an opportunity to teach, I asked, "Ben, if Jason offered to sell you half of his business, how much would you pay? In other words, He'll share half his profits from the gum business with you over the 6 years until he graduates, but he wants you to give him money now. How much would you give him?
Well,
I could see Ben's wheels start to turn now that there might be some real money on the line. Maybe Jason doesn't sell 4 or 5 packs a day, but 3 packs. That's a pretty safe bet. So maybe he makes $3 a day. That's still $15 in a 5-day school week. So 36 weeks in a school year, that's 36 times 15. I might have helped a little in here. That's over $500 a year. Jason has 6 more years of school, so 6 times $500 is $3,000 by the time he graduates. Okay, I said. So I guess you'd pay Jason $1,500 for half of those profits, right? No way, Ben answered quickly. First, why should I pay $1,500 to get back $1,500? That doesn't make any sense. Besides, the $1,500 I get from Jason will take 6 years to collect. Why would I give him $1,500 now to get back $1,500 over 6 years? Also, maybe Jason does a little better than I figure, and I get more than $1,500. But he could do worse, too.
Yeah, I chimed in. Maybe other kids start to sell gum in school, and Jason has so much competition he can't sell as much.
Nah, Jason's practically a superhero, Ben says. I don't think anyone can sell as well as Jason, so I'm not too worried about that.
So I see your point, I responded. Jason's got a good business, but $1,500 is too much to pay for half. But what if Jason offered you half his business for $1? Would you buy it then?
Of course, Ben shot back with a "Dad, you're being an idiot" kind of tone. So fine, I said, ignoring the tone for a moment. The right price is somewhere between $1 and $1,500. Now we're getting closer, but how much would you pay?
$450. That's how much I'd pay today. If I collected $1,500 over the next 6 years, I think that would be a good deal, Ben said, evidently pleased with his decision.
Great, I responded. Now you finally understand what I do for a living.
Dad, what the heck are you talking about? Now I'm totally lost. I've never seen any gum.
No, Ben, I don't sell gum. I spend my time figuring out what businesses are worth, just like we did with Jason's business. If I can buy a business for a lot less than I think it's worth, I buy it.
Wait a second, blurted out Ben. That sounds too easy. If a business is worth $1,000, why would anyone sell it to you for $500?
Well, as it turned out, Ben's seemingly reasonable and obvious question was actually the magic question that got this whole project started. I told Ben that he had just asked a great question, that believe it or not, there is a place where they sell businesses at half price all the time. I told him that I could teach him where to look and how to buy those bargains for himself. But of course, I told him, there was a catch. The catch isn't that the answer is incredibly complicated. It's not. The catch isn't that you have to be some kind of genius or super spy to find $1,000 bills selling for $500. You don't. In fact, I decided to write this book so that Ben and his siblings could not only understand what I do for a living, but also so that they could learn how to start finding these bargain investments for themselves. I figure whatever career they choose in the future, even if it's not money management, a career I'm not necessarily encouraging, they'll definitely need to learn how to invest some of their earnings. But, like I told Ben, there is a catch. The catch is that you have to listen to a long story. You have to take the time to understand the story. And most important, you have to actually believe that the story is true. In fact, the story even concludes with a magic formula that can make you rich over time. I kid you not. Unfortunately, if you don't believe the magic formula will make you rich, it won't. On the other hand, if you believe the story I'm going to tell you, I mean really, truly believe, then you can choose to make money with or without the formula. The formula will take significantly less time and effort than doing the work yourself, and will provide better results for most people. But you can decide which way to go when you're done listening. Okay, I know what you're thinking. What's this belief stuff about? Are we talking about a new religion, maybe something to do with Peter Pan or the Wizard of Oz? I won't even bring up the witch inside the crystal ball thing. That still scares the heck out of me. Or the flying monkeys. mainly because neither has anything to do with my story. And what about the getting rich part? What's that? Can a book really teach you how to get rich? That doesn't make sense. If it could, everyone would be rich. That's especially true for a book that claims to have a magic formula. If everyone knows the magic formula and everyone can't be rich, pretty soon the formula will have to stop working. But I told you this was a long story. I'm going to start from the very beginning. For my kids and most others, almost all of this stuff will be new. For adults, even if they think they know a lot about investing already, even if they've been to graduate business school, and even if they manage other people's money professionally, most have learned wrong. And they've learned wrong from the beginning. Very few people really believe the story I'm going to tell. I know this because if they did, if they really, truly did, there would be a lot more successful investors out there. There aren't. I believe I can teach you and each of my children to be one of them. So let's get started. Chapter 2. Actually, just getting started is a big deal. It takes a great amount of discipline to save any money. After all, no matter how much money you earn or receive from others, it's simply much easier and more immediately rewarding to find something to spend it on. When I was young, I decided that all my money should go to Johnson Smith. Of course, I'd love to tell you that Johnson Smith was an orphan who just needed a little help. I'd love to tell you that the money given to Johnson Smith helped change his life. I'd love to tell you that, but it wouldn't be completely accurate. You see, Johnson Smith was a company, not just any company either. It was a company that sold whoopee cushions, itching powder, and imitation dog vomit through the mail. I mean, I didn't completely throw away all my money. I did buy some educational stuff, too. Once, the guys at Johnson Smith were able to sell me a weather balloon that was 10 feet tall and 30 feet around. I'm not sure what a giant balloon had to do with the weather, but it sounded educational, sort of. Anyway, after my brother and I finally figured out how to blow it up by somehow reversing the airflow on the vacuum cleaner, we ran into a big problem. The 10-foot balloon was quite a bit larger than our front door. Using a complicated formula that not even Einstein could fully comprehend, we decided that if we turned our backs and pushed really hard, the giant balloon could be squeezed out without bursting the balloon or damaging the door. And besides, our mother wasn't home yet. And it worked. Except we forgot one thing. It seems that the air outside was colder than the air inside our house. That meant that we had filled our balloon with warm air. And since, as everyone except apparently me and my brother knew, hot air rises, the balloon started to float away. The two of us were left chasing a giant balloon down the street for about half a mile before it finally popped on a tree. Luckily, I learned a valuable lesson from the whole experience. Although I don't exactly remember what that was, I'm pretty sure it had something to do with the importance of saving money for things that you might want or need in the future, rather than wasting money buying giant weather balloons that you get to chase down the block for all of 3 or 4 minutes. But for our purposes, let's assume that we can all agree that it is important to save money for the future. Let's also assume that you have been able to resist the many temptations of the Johnson Smith people and the thousands of other places calling out for your money. That you, or your parents, have been able to provide for all the necessities of life, including food, clothing, and shelter. And that by being careful about how much you spend, you have somehow been able to put aside at least a small amount of money. Your challenge is to put that money, let's say $1,000, someplace where it can grow to be even more money. Sounds simple enough. Sure, you can just put it under your mattress or in your piggy bank, but when you come to get it, even years later, you'll still be left with the same $1,000 you put there in the first place. It won't grow at all. In fact, if the prices of the things you were going to buy with that money go up during the time your money was just sitting there, and therefore your $1,000 will buy less stuff than it used to, your money will actually be worth less than it was worth the day you put it away. In short, the mattress plan kind of stinks. Plan B has got to be better. And it is. Just take that $1,000 over to the bank. Not only will the bank agree to hold your money, they'll pay you for the privilege. Each year, you'll collect interest from the bank, and in most cases, the longer you agree to let them hold your money, the higher the interest rate you'll get. If you agree to keep your $1,000 with the bank for 5 years, you might collect something like 5% in interest payments per year. So the first year, you collect $50 in interest on your $1,000 original deposit, and now you will have $1,050 in the bank at the beginning of year two. In year two, you collect another 5% interest on the new higher total of $1,050, or $52.50 in interest, and so on through year five. After 5 years, your $1,000 will grow into $1,276. Not bad, and certainly a lot better than the mattress plan. Which brings us to Plan C. This plan is known as Who Needs the Bank? There's an easy way to just skip the bank altogether and lend to businesses or to a group of individuals yourself. Often businesses borrow money directly by selling bonds. The corner bakery won't usually sell these, but larger, multi-million-dollar companies such as McDonald's do it all the time. If you purchase a $1,000 bond from a large company, for example, that company might agree to pay you 8% each year and pay back your original $1,000 after 10 years. That clearly beats the crummy 5% the bank was willing to pay you. There's one little problem, though. If you buy a bond from one of these companies and something goes wrong with its business, you may never get your interest or your money back. That's why riskier companies, say Bob's House of Flapjacks and Pickles, usually have to pay higher interest rates than more solid established ones. That's why a company's bonds have to pay more than the bank. People need to make more money on their bond to make up for the risk that they may not receive the promised interest rate or their original money back. Of course, if you're not comfortable taking any risk of losing your $1,000, the U.S. government sells bonds too. While there's nothing completely riskless in this world, lending money to the U.S. government is the closest any of us will ever get. If you're willing to lend the U.S. government your money for 10 years, the government might, for example, agree to pay you something like 6% per year. If you lend for shorter periods of time, say 5 years, the rate will usually be lower, maybe 4 or 5%. For our purposes, the bond we'll be looking at most is the U.S. government bond that matures, pays off the original loan, after 10 years. We'll be looking at that one because 10 years is a long time. We'll want to compare how much we can earn from a safe bet like a U.S. government bond with our other long-term investment choices. So if the annual interest rate on the 10-year government bond is 6%, that essentially means that people who are willing to lend their money out for 10 years but are unwilling to take any risk of losing their original investment or of not receiving the promised interest rate can still expect to receive 6% each year on their money. In other words, for people willing to lock their money up for 10 years, the no-risk rate of return is 6% per year. It's important to understand what that means. It means that if anyone asks you to loan them money or to invest with them over the long term, they better expect to pay you more than 6% a year. Why? Because you can get 6% a year without taking any risk. All you have to do is lend money to the U.S. government, and they'll guarantee that you receive your 6% each and every year, along with all of your money back after 10 years. If Jason wants money for a share of his gum business, that investment better earn you more than 6% per year, or no way should you do it. If Jason wants to borrow money over the long term, same deal. He better expect to pay you a lot more than 6%. After all, you can get 6% risk-free by lending to the U.S. government. And that's it. There are only a few things you need to remember from this chapter. Quick summary. Number one, you can stick your money under the mattress, but that plan kind of stinks. Number two, you can put your money in the bank or buy bonds from the U.S. government. You will be guaranteed an interest rate and your money back with no risk. Bank deposits up to $100,000 are guaranteed by an agency of the U.S. government. You must hold your bank deposit or your bond until it matures, possibly 5 or 10 years, depending upon what you buy, to guarantee no loss of your original investment. Number three, you can buy bonds sold by companies or other groups. You will be promised higher interest rates than you could get by putting your money in the bank or by buying government bonds. But you could lose some or all of your money, so you better get paid enough for taking the risk. Number four, you can do something else with your money. We'll talk about what in the next chapter. And I almost forgot. Number five, hot air rises. Hey, I did learn something from that balloon after all. Thanks, Johnson Smith. I'm going to make your life even simpler. As I write this, the 10-year U.S. government bond rate is substantially lower than 6%. However, whenever the long-term government bond is paying less than 6%, we'll still assume the rate is 6%. In other words, our other investment alternatives will, at a minimum, still have to beat 6%, no matter how low long-term U.S. government bond interest rates go. The big picture is that we want to make sure we earn a lot more from our other investments than we could earn without taking any risk. Obviously, if long-term U.S. government bond rates rose to 7% or higher, we would use 7% or that higher number. Now that's really it. Chapter 3. Okay, what else can you do with your money? Let's face it, putting money in the bank or lending it to the government is really boring. Hey, I know. Why don't we just go to the track and bet it all on a horse? Nah, I actually tried that. Didn't work out too well. I even tried the dog races. That's where a bunch of greyhound dogs run around in a circle chasing a little mechanical rabbit. It's fun to watch, and you get to hang out with some really great people. Some of them even have teeth. You know what, though? On second thought, maybe that's not such a good idea either. I kind of figured it wasn't for me after my dog actually caught the rabbit. My little guy got trampled by the other dogs on the first turn, got up, and started running the wrong way. Unfortunately, the mechanical rabbit zips around the track at about 60 miles an hour, and when my dog, the one I had placed my faith in and my money on, took a flying leap at the rabbit speeding toward him, let's just say it wasn't pretty. All right, since you're probably concerned, the dog slammed into the 60-mile-per-hour rabbit at full speed, flew 30 feet in the air, and was tragically disqualified. Which meant, alas, I had lost all of my money. And yes, the dog was fine. In any case, now that we've explored most of the logical alternatives for your money, though I'm sure they race worms and various crustaceans someplace I haven't found yet, let's look at one more. How about investing in a business? After all, Jason's going to grow up someday. Maybe he'll open up his own gum store. Better yet, maybe he'll open up a whole bunch of gum stores, usually referred to as a chain of stores, under some catchy name like Jason's Gum Shops. Let's assume that Jason personally trains all the salespeople in his unique brand of gum selling, and that the chain is wildly successful. It could happen. Now Jason comes to you willing to sell half his business. He wants to buy a new pair of sunglasses, a real limousine, and maybe a house for himself and the lucky Mrs. Jason. Only now, he's asking for big bucks, and we'll have to do some serious figuring before we can decide whether to take Jason up on his offer. It turns out that Jason's grown up quite a bit since the days when he scootered himself around town, and he now wants a hefty $6 million for half ownership of his business. Of course, $6 million is more than most of us can afford. But luckily, Jason isn't looking to sell half ownership of his business all to one person. In fact, Jason has decided to divide ownership of his business into 1 million equal pieces, or shares, as they're referred to on Wall Street. Jason's plan is to keep 500,000 shares for himself and sell his other 500,000 shares for $12 apiece, or $6 million in total. Anyone interested in buying part of Jason's business at that price can buy 1 share for $12, 100 shares for $1,200, 1,000 shares for $12,000, or pretty much any number of shares they want. If you were to buy, for example, 10,000 shares costing $120,000, you would then own 1% of Jason's Gum Shops, 10,000 shares divided by the 1 million share total. That 1% doesn't mean that you would own the Spearmint Gum Department or a small piece of one of Jason's stores. Your 10,000 shares, or 1% ownership, of Jason's Gum Shops means that you would be entitled to 1% of the future earnings of the entire Jason's Gum Shops business. Now, of course, all you would have to do is figure out whether paying $120,000 for 1% of Jason's future gum profits is a good deal. This is where our analysis gets a little sticky.
We have to be good gumshoes so we don't blow it and have our money chewed up and spit out. Anyway, you get the idea. Luckily, Jason has provided us with a lot of information. Since we already know that Jason wants $12 for each share in Jason's gum shops, and that there are 1 million shares in total, this is referred to as 1 million shares outstanding, this means that Jason thinks his business is worth $12 million. Therefore, he thinks that 1% of his business is worth the $120,000 we just talked about. Well, that's all fine and dandy, but what matters here is what we think it's worth. So let's take a look at some of the other information Jason has given us. It seems that last year, Jason sold a total of $10 million worth of gum from the 10 stores in the highly successful Jason's Gum Shops chain. Of course, the $10 million is how much gum Jason's stores sold, but unfortunately, $10 million isn't how much profit Jason made. Obviously, Jason's stores ran up a few expenses along the way. Naturally, there was the cost of the gum that Jason sold. That totaled $6 million. That left him with $4 million in profits. But wait, we're far from finished. There was the rent Jason had to pay for the use of his 10 store locations. Then there were those pesky employees who, for some reason, expected to get paid for selling gum and keeping the stores clean and running smoothly. There were electricity and heating costs, trash removal, and accounting, and all kinds of administrative costs, so Jason could keep track of all the money and gum flying all over the place. And that stuff adds up. In this case, another $2 million in expenses, to be exact. That got Jason's business down to $2 million in profits. But as you suspected, we're not done yet. Jason's business had to pay taxes. The government needs money to provide services to its citizens, and profitable businesses must pay their share of taxes to keep it going. In the case of Jason's gum shops, that tax is equal to 40% of income, a fairly standard rate for many businesses. So 40% of the $2 million in profits that Jason's gum business earned last year had to go to the government in the form of taxes. Since 40% of $2 million is $800,000, that left Jason's gum shops with a net profit of $1.2 million. Actually, Jason provided us with all that information about last year's income in a very neat table, known as an income statement. See table 3.1 in the PDF file. So there you have it. Jason's gum shops earned $1.2 million last year. Jason thinks that makes the business worth a total of $12 million. He is willing to sell us a piece of that business, in any size, up to half the entire business, at that $12 million valuation. That is, $6 million for half, $1.2 million for a 10% stake, $120,000 for 1% ownership, and one share equaling 1/1000th of the business for a measly $12. Should we do it? To keep it simple, let's take a look at what we'll be getting for each $12 share. Well, Jason has divided his business into 1 million equal shares. That means if the whole business earned $1,200,000, each share earned 1/1000th of that amount. Since $1,200,000 divided by 1 million is $1.20, each $12 share was entitled to $1.20 in earnings. Is that a good deal? Let's look at it this way. If we invest $12 for a piece of Jason's business, and it earns us $1.20 in the first year, our first year return on our investment would be $1.20 divided by $12, or 10%. A 10% return in our first year. Pretty darn good, right? In Chapter 2, we discussed that, at the very least, we had to beat the 6% annual return from a 10-year U.S. government bond. That's because buying those bonds would earn us 6% without having to take any risk. Since earning 10% is clearly more than earning 6%, ipso facto, is it then true that paying $12 for a share that earns $1.20 is a good deal? Well, life isn't quite that simple. But as we'll see in a later chapter, almost. The bottom line is, we're off to a great start, but we have to consider a few more things before we can make up our mind. First, $1.20 per share is what Jason's gum shops earned last year. We have to determine whether we think the business will earn that $1.20 in the coming year, or more than that, or maybe less.
Last year's earnings may be a good starting point for estimating next year's earnings, but it may not. If Jason's Gum Shops doesn't earn $1.20 next year, the business won't be earning that 10% we expected on the $12 per share we just paid. It could be higher, but it could be lower. Second, once we come up with our estimate for how much Jason's business will earn next year, we have to determine how confident we are in our prediction. If we're taking a wild guess because we have no idea whether gum sales are steady from year to year, whether Jason's gum stores are just a fad, or whether new competition from other candy stores will affect Jason's profits, then our estimate may be suspect. But we have to be reasonable. If we're not sure whether earnings will be $1.50 or $2 per share, that kind of uncertainty is fine. Both of those numbers will represent that Jason's business is earning more than that 10% on our initial $12 per share cost. On the other hand, if we're uncertain whether the earnings will be 20 cents per share or $1.20, then our guaranteed 6% from the government bond may start to look a whole lot better. The third little detail we haven't yet considered is that next year is only 1 year. Even if Jason's Gum Shops earns $1.20 next year, or a lot more or a lot less, what about all the years after that? Will earnings keep growing every year? Maybe each store will keep selling more gum each year, and earnings will increase that way. Or maybe if 10 stores can make $1.20 per share, getting to 20 stores in a few years will cause earnings to grow to $2.40 per share, or even higher. Of course, the gum business could always turn sour, in the next few years, causing gum earnings to remain stuck at levels well below $1.20 for a long time. And there's more. Okay, you're beginning to panic. I can feel it. This stuff is too hard. How are you going to figure it all out? How can anyone? And even if you take your best shot, am I expecting you, and my kids for that matter, to gamble real money on a pile of guesses and estimates? And, oh yeah, aren't there tons of MBAs, PhDs, smart financial types, and professional investment analysts, not to mention full-time money managers, trying to figure out pretty much the same things? How can little old you compete with all those hard-working, smart, sophisticated guys? All right, already, enough. Calm down. Sheesh, can I take you anywhere? Have a little faith. Hang in there. I'll do that summary thing. Tell you what's important to remember, and we'll move on. Man, if I have to hold your hand for every little thing. So, here's what you need to know. Number one, buying a share in a business means you are purchasing a portion, or percentage interest, of that business. You are then entitled to a portion of that business's future earnings. Number two, figuring out what a business is worth involves estimating, okay, guessing, how much the business will earn in the future. Number three, the earnings from your share of the profits must give you more money than you would receive by placing that same amount of money in a risk-free 10-year U.S. government bond. Remember, last chapter we set 6% as your absolute minimum annual return when government bond rates fall below 6%. And, number four, no, I haven't forgotten about the magic formula, but you're going to have to stop bugging me about it, okay? Sheesh. Chapter 4. Great. Figuring out what a business is worth isn't easy. After lots of guessing and estimating, maybe you get it right, and maybe you get it wrong. But what if you could? What if you could figure out what a business was really worth? Is there something you could do with that information? Is there really a place, like I promised in the first chapter, a place where you can buy a business for half its true value? A place where you can get $1,000 of value for only $500? You bet there is. But first, let's spend a few minutes in business school. For the past 9 years, I have taught an investing course to a group of graduate business students at an Ivy League university. Needless to say, this is a pretty smart group of students. Each year, on the first day of class, I walk in and open the newspaper to the financial section. Found there are pages and pages of tables with lots of numbers in tiny print. Sounds great so far, right? Anyway, posted in these tables is a list of company names, and next to each name is a bunch of prices. Call out the name of a big, well-known company, I say. The students come up with companies like General Electric, IBM, General Motors, and Abercrombie & Fitch. Actually, it doesn't really matter what companies the students shout out. My main point is so easy to make, any company name in almost any industry, large or small, well-known or not, will do. The result is always the same. I look in the paper next to General Electric and read off the numbers. It says here that the price for one share of General Electric was $35 yesterday. It also says here that the highest price that General Electric shares have sold for over the last year was $53 per share. The lowest price for a share over the last year was $29. For IBM, it's the same thing. You could have purchased one share of IBM yesterday for $85. Over the past year, shares of IBM have sold for as much as $93, and for as little as $55. General Motors sold for $37 per share yesterday, but over the last year, shares have sold for between $30 and $68. For Abercrombie & Fitch, which was selling for $27 per share yesterday, the range of prices per share over the last year has been between $15 per share at the lowest and just over $33 per share for a high price. I then point out that that's a pretty wide range of prices for shares and a pretty short period of time for them to change so much. Looking at the price for shares over a 2 to 3 year period would give us an even wider range. So here's the question that I always ask. How can this be? These are big, well-known companies. Each of these companies has divided its ownership into millions and sometimes billions of equal shares, just like Jason did with his gum shops. Initially, companies sell their shares to the public, to both individuals and big institutional investors. After that, though, the people who buy these shares are free to sell them to anyone they want. Each day, the newspaper lists the names of thousands of companies and the price at which people have been buying and selling an ownership share in each. The trading back and forth of these ownership shares takes place in a number of locations and over computer networks. These ownership shares are referred to as shares of stock. And collectively, this buying and selling activity is referred to as the stock market. A company as large as IBM or General Motors might have divided its ownership stake into something like a billion equal shares. That means that if at one point during the year you can purchase one share of General Motors for $30, and for our example, we assume the ownership of General Motors has been divided into 1 billion equal pieces or shares, then the implied price to purchase the entire company, all 1 billion shares, would be $30 billion. However, if at some point during the same year, General Motors shares could have been purchased for $60 each, that would indicate that the cost to purchase all of General Motors would be $60 billion. So, I ask the question again, how can this be? Can the value of General Motors, the largest car manufacturer in North America, change that much within the same year? Can a company that large be worth $30 billion one day, and then a few months later be worth $60 billion? Are they selling twice as many cars, making twice as much money, or doing something drastically different in their business to justify such a large change in value? Of course, it's possible. But what about the big price changes in IBM, Abercrombie & Fitch, and General Electric? Does something happen each and every year to account for large changes in the value of most companies? Remember, every year, the results are the same. For pretty much any company that my students name, the range of high and low prices over the course of only 1 year is huge. Does this make sense? Well, to save the class time, and since my attention span is usually a matter of seconds, I usually blurt out the answer. No, it makes no sense that the values of most companies swing wildly from high to low or low to high during the course of each and every year. On the other hand, it seems pretty clear that the prices of the shares in most companies swing around wildly each and every year. All you have to do is look in the newspaper to see that that's true. So, I ask my room full of smart, sophisticated students to try to explain why. Why do the prices of all these businesses move around so much each year if the values of their businesses can't possibly change that much? Well, it's a good question. So I generally let my students spend some time offering up complicated explanations and theories. In fact, it's such a good question that professors have developed whole fields of economic, mathematical, and social study to try to explain it. Even more incredible, most of this academic work has involved coming up with theories as to why something that clearly makes no sense actually makes sense. You have to be really smart to do that. So, why do share prices move around so much every year when it seems clear that the values of the underlying businesses do not? Well, here's how I explain it to my students. Who knows and who cares? Maybe people go nuts a lot. Maybe it's hard to predict future earnings. Maybe it's hard to decide what a fair rate of return on your purchase price is. Maybe people get a little depressed sometimes and don't want to pay a lot for stuff. Maybe people get excited sometimes and are willing to pay a lot. So maybe people simply justify high prices by making high estimates for future earnings when they are happy, and justify low prices by making low estimates when they are sad. But like I said, maybe people just go nuts a lot. Still my favorite. The truth is that I don't really have to know why people are willing to buy and sell shares of most companies at wildly different prices over very short periods of time. I just have to know that they do. Why is this helpful? Let's think about that. Suppose you figured that a business, perhaps one like Jason's Gum Shops, was worth between $10 and $12 per share, and at varying times during the year, its shares could be purchased for between $6 and $11. Well, if you were confident about your estimate of what the business was worth, then deciding whether to buy shares when they were trading near $11 might be a difficult decision. But when shares in that same company during that same year were available at close to $6, your decision might well become much easier. At $6 per share, if your estimates of value were close to correct, then you would be buying shares in Jason's Gum Shops for only 50 or 60 cents on the dollar, for 50 or 60% of what they were truly worth. One of the greatest stock market writers and thinkers, Benjamin Graham, put it this way. Imagine that you are partners in the ownership of a business with a crazy guy named Mr. Market. Mr. Market is subject to wild mood swings. Each day he offers to buy your share of the business or sell you his share of the business at a particular price. Mr. Market always leaves the decision completely to you, and every day you have three choices. You can sell your shares to Mr. Market at his stated price, you can buy Mr. Market's shares at that same price, or you can do nothing. Sometimes Mr. Market is in such a good mood that he names a price that is much higher than the true worth of the business. On those days, it would probably make sense for you to sell Mr. Market your share of the business. On other days, he is in such a poor mood that he names a very low price for the business. On those days, you might want to take advantage of Mr. Market's crazy offer to sell you shares at such a low price, and to buy Mr. Market's share of the business. If the price named by Mr. Market is neither very high nor extraordinarily low relative to the value of the business, you might very logically choose to do nothing. In the world of the stock market, that's exactly how it works. The stock market is Mr. Market. If, according to the daily newspaper, General Motors is selling for $37 per share, you have three choices. You can buy shares in General Motors for $37 each. You can sell your shares in General Motors and receive $37 each. Or you can do nothing. If you think GM is really worth $70 per share, then you might consider $37 a ridiculously low price and decide to buy some shares. If you think GM is really worth only $30 or $35 per share, and you happen to own some shares, you might decide to sell to Mr. Market at $37. If you think each share of General Motors is worth between $40 and $45 per share, you may decide to do nothing. At $37 per share, the price is not at a big enough discount for you to buy.
Nor is $37 a generous enough offer to make you want to sell.
In short, you are never required to act. You alone can choose to act only when the price offered by Mr. Market appears very low, when you might decide to buy some shares, or extremely high, when you might consider selling any shares you own to Mr. Market. Graham referred to this practice of buying shares of a company only when they trade at a large discount to true value as investing with a margin of safety. The difference between your estimated value per share of, say, $70 and the purchase price of your shares of perhaps $37 would represent a margin of safety for your investment. If your original calculations of the value of shares in a company like General Motors were too high, or the car business unexpectedly took a turn for the worse after your purchase, the margin of safety in your original purchase price could still protect you from losing money. Even if you originally estimated fair value to be $70, and it turned out that $60 or even $50 was closer to the true value for each share, a purchase price of $37 would leave enough margin for you to still make money on your original investment. Graham figured that always using the margin of safety principle when deciding whether to purchase shares of a business from a crazy partner like Mr. Market was the secret to making safe and reliable investment profits. In fact, these two concepts, requiring a margin of safety for your investment purchases and viewing the stock market as if it were a partner like Mr. Market, have been used with much success by some of the greatest investors of all time. But wait, there's still a problem here. Okay, maybe a few. First, as we discussed, how are you supposed to know what a business is worth? If you can't place a fair value on a company, then you can't divide that number by the number of shares that exist, and you can't figure out what the fair value of a share of stock is. So, even if a share of General Motors sells for $30 on one day, and $60 per share a few months later, you have no idea whether one of those prices is cheap, and one is expensive, or both are cheap, or both expensive, or whatever. In short, from what we've learned so far, you wouldn't know a bargain price if it hit you in the head. Second, if you could figure out a fair price or price range for the business, how would you know whether you were right or even close to right? Remember, in the process of figuring out the value of a business, all you do is make a bunch of guesses and estimates. Those estimates involve predicting earnings for a business for many years into the future. Even experts, whatever that means, have a tough time doing that. Third, as we already covered, aren't there tons of smart, hard-working people trying to figure out all this stuff too? Aren't there lots of stock market analysts and professional investors who spend their time trying to figure out what companies are really worth? Even if I could really teach you how to invest, wouldn't these smart, knowledgeable, and experienced people be better at it than you? Wouldn't these people scoop up all of the obvious bargains before you get there? How can you compete with those guys? All you did was buy a book. A book that says even kids, okay, teenagers, can learn how to make big money in the stock market. Does that make sense? What chance do you really have? Well, a sane person might start to feel a little foolish about now. But you paid good money for this book. You could already be a few cards short of a full deck. So at least we've got that going for us. In any case, ready or not, here comes the summary. Number one, stock prices move around wildly over very short periods of time. This does not mean that the values of the underlying companies have changed very much during that same period. In effect, the stock market acts very much like a crazy guy named Mr. Market. Number two, it's a good idea to buy shares of a company at a big discount to your estimated value of those shares. Buying shares at a large discount to value will provide you with a large margin of safety and lead to safe and consistently profitable investments. Number three, from what we've learned so far, you wouldn't know a bargain price stock if it hit you in the head. Number four, being a few cards short of a full deck, you might as well keep listening. Chapter 5. I love movies, and The Karate Kid is one of my favorites. Of course, I would like any art form where eating popcorn and candy are part of the deal. But there's one scene in this particular movie that holds special meaning for me. In it, the old karate master, Mr. Miyagi, is supposed to be teaching his teenage apprentice, Daniel, how to fight. The boy is new at school and being bullied by a group of karate-trained toughs. Daniel hopes learning karate will help him stand up to his tormentors and win the girl of his dreams. But instead of teaching him karate, Mr. Miyagi puts Daniel to work, waxing cars, painting fences, and sanding floors. So after a whirlwind of scenes showing poor Daniel working his fingers to the bone, waxing, painting, and sanding, the youth has finally had enough. He confronts Mr. Miyagi and essentially says, "Why am I wasting my time doing these simple and menial tasks when I should be learning karate?" Mr. Miyagi has Daniel stand up from his sanding duties and starts throwing jabs at the young boy while yelling, "Wax on, wax off." Daniel deflects each jab with the swirling motions he learned from so many hours waxing cars. Next, Mr. Miyagi throws a punch while yelling, "Paint the fence." Once again, Daniel deflects the punch, this time using the up-and-down action of painting a fence. Similarly, Mr. Miyagi's karate kick is then stopped by Daniel's expert floor-sanding ability. In effect, by learning these few simple techniques, Daniel has unwittingly become a karate master. Now, in good movies, the viewer participates in something called the willing suspension of disbelief. In other words, we kind of know that Ralph Macchio, the actor who plays Daniel in the movie, couldn't really use that waxing thing to defend himself in a dark alley. In the real world, before he could finish his first coat, Mr. Macchio would probably get smacked in the head and drop like a sack of potatoes. But while caught up in a movie, we're ready and more than willing to believe that Mr. Miyagi's simple methods can truly work wonders. Well, I'm going to have to ask you to do a little suspending of disbelief, too. Not because what you're going to learn doesn't make sense. On the contrary, the two concepts in this chapter are simple and obvious. It's just that these two concepts are so very basic, you'll have a hard time believing that such simple tools can turn you into a stock market master. But pay close attention now, and I promise you won't get a smack in the head later. When we last left Jason, the hero of our story, he had just asked us to chew over an exciting proposal. His proposal was simple. Would we want to buy a piece of his wildly successful chain of gum stores, Jason's Gum Shops? You want some, you know you want some. But as much as Jason wanted to sell us a piece of his business, giving him an answer wasn't turning out to be so simple. By looking at the income statement that Jason had provided us, it turned out that Jason's chain of 10 gum shops had earned a total of $1.2 million last year. Pretty impressive. Since Jason had divided his business into 1 million equal shares, we had concluded that each share was therefore entitled to $1.20 in earnings, $1,200,000 divided by 1 million shares. At Jason's asking price of $12 for each share, that meant that based on last year's earnings, Jason's Gum Shops would have given us a 10% return for each $12 share purchased. $1.20 divided by $12 equals 10%. That 10% return, calculated by dividing the earnings per share for the year by the share price, is known as the earnings yield. We then compared the earnings yield of 10% we could receive from an investment in Jason's business with the 6% return we could earn risk-free from investing in a 10-year U.S. government bond. We concluded, without too much trouble, that earning 10% per year on our investment was better than earning 6%. Of course, although that analysis was simple, we identified a bunch of problems. First, Jason's Gum Shops earned that $1.20 per share last year. Next year's earnings might turn out to be a completely different story. If Jason's business earned less than $1.20 next year, we wouldn't earn a 10% return on our investment, and maybe we would be better off with a sure 6% from the government bond. Second, even if Jason's business did earn the $1.20 per share next year, or even more, that's only 1 year. How do we know, or how would we ever know, how much Jason's Gum Shops would earn in future years? It could be a lot more than $1.20 per share, but it could be a lot less. and our earnings yield could drop significantly below the 6% we could have earned risk-free from the U.S. government. Lastly, even if we had an opinion about future earnings, how could we ever have any confidence that our predictions would turn out to be right? In short,